Welcome, everyone. This fourth in our series of five food waste webinars is brought to you by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Region 2, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, in partnership with the Solid Waste Resource Renewal Group at the Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station. I'm Gary Fineland. I'm with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and I'll be introducing the webinars and speakers. The webinar series is designed to provide tips and tools for food waste generators. We're happy to have you participating today. Today's webinar focuses on diverting food scraps from disposal through composting and anaerobic digestion. Before I introduce today's speakers, I'll turn the line over to Amy Wolfram to go over some of the call logistics. Amy?
Thanks, Gary. Hello, everyone. My name is Amy Wolfram, and I'm a contractor for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. As a reminder, this is a recorded session. If you have problems connecting to the webinar, reference either the screen that's up right now that has the toll-free number and the participant passcode, or call 866-237-3252. As a reminder, the slides are moved for you during this webinar. There may be about a 10-second delay between slides. If you're listening through your computer speakers and you hear an echo during the webinar, please turn down the computer volume. Note that in order to listen through the phone line, you must dial the phone line and enter the participant code assigned to you when you registered with the webinar, and it's also on the screen of the live meeting right now. Note also that there'll be a several-second delay as we transition between speakers, so please be patient during these periods. We encourage questions, and we're holding them until the end of the webinar. We ask that you make either note of your questions throughout the presentation, or you can use the question and answer log, which is a tab at the top of your screen that says Q&A, and you can enter your questions in there. Since we're holding all the presentations, all the questions till the end of the presentations, it's best if you have a question for a specific presenter that you put their name in front of the question. That will help us note if the question is for a particular presenter. We have two Bobs presenting today, so if when you note your question, if you could say Bob R or Bob S, that would help. For Bob Rink or Bob Spencer, that would help us to identify which Bob the question is directed to. And with that, Gary, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Amy. And so on to who those Bobs are. We have Bob Rink with the State University of New York in Cobleskill, Bob Spencer, environmental planning consultant, and we also have a Tom Lawson of Northeast Biogas. Thanks again for participating, and we'll get started with our first speaker, Bob Rink. Bob Rink has been researching and teaching about composting for over 25 years. He's the Associate Professor of Agricultural Engineering at the State University of New York, the Cobleskill campus, that's SUNY Cobleskill. At his request, I've kept his bio short to allow more time for his presentation. Bob?
Well, thank you, Gary. Well, I'm very happy to be here. This is my first webinar presentation, so going to be a bit strange to me. I'm used to standing up in front of a classroom full of students, and I can see who's making faces at me and sleeping. So I may pause every now and then out of habit just for that reason. But I do have a lot of slides. That's one of the reasons why I asked Gary to keep the introduction short, and I'll do my best to get through them on time. I may rush through, but you can always ask me questions at the end. I'm going to address the option of recycling food residuals by composting, on a farm, in a farm environment. And I'm going to do this basically by providing a few examples and presenting some prescribed questions, predetermined questions, which I'll go on to answer. And again, if there's any questions left over, we have the Q&A period to address those. So the first question is, why? There's two parts to this as I'm addressing them. One is, why composting at all? Here's a list of reasons why you might want to compost food residuals as opposed to some of the other options. And they include being able to capture the nutrients and organic matter that are are inherent in food residuals and have some value. Another reason that's gaining a lot of attention is to reduce the potential methane emissions on the way to and at landfills. And also, there's the possibility of reducing transportation costs and energy, of course, and the energy associated with transportation. That, of course, depends upon where you are and where the wastes need to go. In addition, the food wastes are generally pretty moist, and they can provide some needed moisture for dry composting feedstock, so they can be an advantage for the composter. And a good deal of that organic matter will go into making compost. Not all of it. A lot of food organic matter ends up as carbon dioxide, but at least the fibrous part stays behind to make compost. So the next question, so that's the why composting. The next question would be, well, why compost on the farm? And this is one of my favorite pictures because it portrays simplicity. And basically, a farmer could start composting with nothing more than a bucket loader, a manure spreader, and a hat. And even the manure spreader is not necessary. And most farmers have a bucket loader and a hat and could easily start composting right away. And one of the advantages of composting is that it is so simple and easy to carry out. Another reason to compost on the farm is that there's a good deal of precedent for it. I mean, there's a long history of composting on the farm. And let's just talk about modern agriculture. And historically, feedstock materials have been composted on farms to capture the nutrients. But more recently, farm composting started as a commercial enterprise, probably in a large scale, in the 70s. And here are two examples of farm composting from that period. The one on the upper left is a feedstock in Ohio, and one on the bottom is a very interesting application, was a prototype in-vessel composting system that was developed at the University of Maryland. It probably was the beginning of what we now know as agitated bed composting, or Bob Spencer might talk later about an IPS system. This may have been the birth of that. So composting has a long history on farms. Another reason to compost on the farms as opposed to a commercial site is that, you know, farmers are familiar with food materials, the materials we're talking, the feedstocks we're talking about today. I mean, they grow it. They handle it. They handle waste food. They handle good food. They know its characteristics, and they know its limitations. Another reason to look to farms for composting is usually the regulations governing composting are relaxed somewhat in farm situations. And there's a lot of reasons for that, one being, that farmers tend to be less regulated anyway, and there's other good ones as well. This picture portrays this relaxed regulation. This is actually a what I might call a commercial composter. It's not in New York, by the way, as you might have guessed, that has a few cattle, more than a few, wandering around the composting site for the sole reason of being called a farm. And therefore, they were able to avoid certain regulatory requirements because they were a farm and the cattle made them that way. I'm not sure that would fly here in New York or a lot of other places, but it did in this case. And a big reason for composting on the farm is that farmers have the equipment available to carry out composting, and more importantly, to know how to do it. Not just how to use the equipment, but how to do composting. Composting is not unlike other farming activities, and farmers have a lot of knowledge already on how to handle materials, how to handle organic materials, and how to make something from nothing. Farms also provide the advantage of space, and this is an example of that. Not all on-farm composting is done in this manner, but this picture that you see on the screen now is a farm that was using composting as part of its crop rotation. It would move the windrows into fallow fields, and then the next year rotate it to the next fallow field, and then just plow in the remaining compost after the windrows were used, and it's actually a pretty good strategy because any nutrients left behind by the compost were used by the following crop. And here's another example of an innovative use of space on a farm. It's the compost windrows being put in corners of irrigated center pivot systems where the irrigation system doesn't quite catch that area of land, and so it's underutilized land. They decide to put the compost windrows there. These are unusual examples of the availability of space on farms. In more cases than not, the farmer just picks a good site that's well-suited to composting and not especially productive and dedicates that space to it. But at least in most cases, farms have some land available from which they can choose from. Another important reason that composting is good on farms is because farms have a use for the compost. It may be their motivation for composting is to get the compost. It may not be. They may want to make the compost and then sell the compost. But in either case, they have normally farms have a place where they can use the compost. If the primary intention is to sell the compost and they don't sell it at all, at least they have an outlet for it. And many farms are already taking yard trimmings as a composting feedstock. That's been done for well over 20 years now quite commonly. Farms were identified as an outlet for and a place to compost yard trimmings. And yard trimmings are an excellent complement for composting food. They complement the characteristics of food very well. And many of these farms are already taking yard trimmings from communities and generators. Why not just add the food to it? And also important is farms tend to have a lot of feedstocks that can be composted. I'm sure you realize by now that food by itself, at least most food sources, with the exception of some processed foods, cannot be composted well alone. It needs an amendment, and it's helpful to have a lot of other materials that aren't quite as attractive to pests to be mixed with it. And farms normally have ample co-feedstocks and amendments to mix food with. So as a summary, we'll look at the reasons for why composting on the farm. There's a good number. It's local. For instance, there's usually a local farm within close to the generator. There's land available. That land is often inconspicuous land, not easily noticed by neighbors. Most farms or many farms are already odor insulated. That is, the neighborhood expects some odors from farms. The farmers have the expertise and equipment. Farms are generally truck ready. That is, trucks come in and out all the time. So bringing new amendments in wouldn't be, in most cases, too much of a problem. There are suitable amendments, volumes of amendments. It's a way to practice decentralized composting. That is, rather than taking it to one large central facility, you can take it to several smaller facilities, and that has some advantages as well. And at least in theory and concept, you have this food that's being recycled and it's actually going back to a place where food begins, and that's on the farm. All in all, farms are a good place to do composting. So I want to take a moment. I mention this every time I talk about composting and the advantages. And while it's good to bring food to a composting site to recycle it into compost, a better way to handle that is to compost it at the source. So it doesn't have to be collected, it doesn't have to be transported, and it doesn't have to be handled in large quantities. And so I'm always an advocate for backyard or home composting where this can be done with much less effort and much less expense. So that's a good thing to promote. Also, in talking about composting, I know that Tom's going to be talking about this later, but I want to acknowledge the fact that anaerobic digestion is, in fact, is a good alternative to composting, and in fact, maybe preferred, because you can also capture the energy that's inherent into the food. So I don't want to make it seem like I'm advocating composting over anaerobic digestion. Both good alternatives. When I looked at the question of what to compost, I'll go through this quickly. We'll just go through a short parade of possible feedstocks for composting on the farm. And the first would be food materials that might be generated on a farm or like materials that are generated on a farm. And one of those is cold produce. That is, produce that isn't quite good enough to make it to market. And another would be pre-consumer produce. So that produce, again, basically talking about vegetation, fruits and vegetables, that do make it to the market but never make it to the consumer, and the grocery store would be a prime example of that. And then there's post-consumer produce. No problems with taking that on the farm either, and post-consumer produce usually is much more mixed, and it could have other things in it, like paper, napkins, plates, and forks and spoons sometimes. Processed produce is a great example, a great candidate for composting on a farm, and the advantage of processed material is it's generally homogeneous. It's not mixed. There's less likely to have contaminants in it like plastic, and it's a good material to handle. And here are two pretty good examples of farm composting of processed residuals, broccoli on the top, and that is a New York application, and cranberry residuals on the bottom. Also, what I would call sloppy produce, wet material, liquids, can be composted. Example on the left is ice cream. On the top is tomato processing material. Obviously, this material cannot be composted by itself, and you need a lot of dry feedstocks and amendments to absorb the moisture and take the gooiness out of it, if you will. But it can be composted and has been composted. Let's call this not-so-produce, fish waste in this case, can be composted, and obviously it offers some challenges that the other materials do, but it's got a long history of composting both on and off the farms, and here's an example of a recipe for an on-farm composting. Actually, this was a demonstration from the 1980s. And, you know, when you think of some of the worst materials, the most challenging material to compost, like fish waste, think of some of the things that farmers are doing successfully, composting successfully on the farm now, and they're doing it with slaughterhouse waste and animals that die on the farm. It's actually quite a success story for on-farm composting. And in fact, here at SUNY Cobleskill, we built a compost pile out of meat waste just this morning, and it went well. So farmers and composting can handle a lot of nasty food like that. Now, regarding the how, there's lots of ways to go about this, but basically in the how, and this applies to both on- and off-farm situations, you've got to be able to handle the food, and the food is a challenging material. It could be wet, sloppy, potentially quickly odorous, so you have to start off on the right footing when handling food, and usually that means having material on hand to absorb that, to mix it with right away, and things like yard trimmings and manure can do that. This would be an example of starting off on the wrong foot, and that is just dumping the food on the ground and letting it loose without any control of the moisture. Food is challenging, and there are lots of pests that are attracted to it. So a lot of amendments need to be on hand because there are a great potential for pests, like these seagulls, if you can see them here. You won't see birds like this at facilities that don't handle food, but if food's there, they're going to be attracted to it. So it takes special handling. And usually that handling requires, not usually, almost always, immediately covering it, immediately hiding the food from the environment. Okay? Liquids could be absorbed by creating a trench in the window and applying the liquids directly and then covering them up or turning them immediately. When you get into the composting business, farms or off farms, that might also carry you into the collection business. There's a number of farms who tried to get food waste but could not because the generator wants someone to collect it and deliver it. They don't want to do it themselves, and the farm needed to get into that business on their own. If you have collection containers, that might mean you're also being in the cleaning business. And if you're taking post-consumer waste or anything but processing waste, and even processing waste, might be in the picking business as well. Plastic is the principal pest of composters, and it's got to be taken out if it's not eliminated at the source. So that's a good part of it. So in summary, what I call table manners or smart practices for handling food and composting: handle it properly, keep it covered all the time, paint it if and as needed, watch the water, and add porosity. As far as composting methods, there's a number of choices, many choices, but basically it comes down to these questions. You're going to have it open or enclosed. You're going to rely on passive aeration or forced aeration, a turn system or a static system. The nature of food might require you to be more static than turned because it needs to be exposed into something that's not food, no longer attractive to pests, and that may mean letting it sit for a while before it's turned. But the most common methods are require passive aeration. Here are three examples. Passive piles in the upper right-hand corner, and the way animal mortalities are composted on farms is a good example of that. Assisted passive piles are in the lower right-hand corner where there's just, that pile is going to sit there and aerate on its own, but there's some pipes in the bottom to help it along. And then turned windrows, people don't normally think of turned windrows as passively aerated, but in fact they are. The turning does very little for the aeration. It just helps the composting along to the agitation. And turned windrows are, in fact, the most common way to go. And here's an example of a turned windrow system, another example from New York that does include food. Those covers over the windrow are a way to manage moisture from coming in from the weather, from precipitation, but they all do provide some measure of containment as well. They're a good management tool. And the other choice would be open forced aeration. Here's called an aerated static pile. It's static in that it's never turned. It may be moved once or twice, and that's how it gets its agitation. But there are fans that provide the aeration for the composting system and a network of pipes underneath the pile. This is that aerated static pile, only in a building, to provide more control. This is on a farm. You might consider this an aerated static pile only in bins. But the method is exactly the same. It's just the means of containment that's different. And this may be a little more preferred method with food because you have more control over the environment. Here are other ways to contain the system. Again, this is not unlike the aerated static pile, but you're putting an envelope around it to contain it. And in some cases, in some jurisdictions, containment may be required. So local regulatory agency or the state regulatory agency may not allow you to have an open aerated static pile because you're handling food. In that case, some composters have moved to these type systems where there's an envelope by containment. When you're turning, and especially when you're not turning, mixing is an important step, particularly with food, and there are a number of ways to do that. The bottom pictures are mechanical mixers, the horizontal on the left, vertical on the right. But mixing is also commonly done just by repeatedly bucketing material together. Sometimes size reduction is helpful. Sometimes it's necessary with food materials. It depends on the exact materials. Size reduction will always speed up the process. This picture here is a bucket that has flow-turning hammers in the bottom that shred up the material that's in there. An interesting way to go about it. Here's an example of a vertical auger mixer that provides both a little bit of mixing and shredding. In this particular example, they're putting dead livestock in there, and then it's being conveyed right into a drum-type in vessel composting system. We might also quickly ask the question, why not on-farm composting? I mean, there are some limitations. Farms aren't the faraway, isolated places that they used to be, and most farms have some neighborhoods around them, although this is an extreme case, and I'm quite sure this farm is no longer here. But there are neighbors to all farms, and those neighbors complain. And so the risk of that is, while the neighbors are happy to have you as a farm there, they may not be happy to have you as a composter there. And by taking in a lot of off-farm material, like food, you risk the possibility of losing your status as a farm. And here's the case where this particular farm was trying to compost yard trimmings that it was bringing in from the outside, and the neighbors went up in arms and they just said, nope, no composting is not for farming. But I suggest that's an extreme example, and when done right, and in most cases, composting is farming, and it should be encouraged on the farm. It's a good way to farm, and it's a good way to compost. So with that, I'll end my presentation. I suspect I went over a little bit, so I appreciate your patience.
Thanks, Bob. That was great. Good slides. Our next speaker is Bob Spencer. Bob has a wide range of solid waste composting experience, having served as the plant manager for the Bedminster facility in Marlboro, Massachusetts. While at the Marlboro facility, he started the supermarket composting program that served 15 stores. Bob currently works part-time for Mass Natural, a composting company in Westminster, Massachusetts. He is also a contributing editor for BioCycle magazine and a consultant to a number of communities, states, and companies. Bob has a BS from Allegheny College, Meadville, Pennsylvania, and a master's in science from SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, Syracuse, New York. Bob?
Thank you, Gary, and I appreciate all the audience out there tuning in today. I have about 40 slides, and I'll try to move through them. Gary had asked when they set this up to try to illustrate the variety of approaches that are out there with in-vessel composting technologies. Through my work with BioCycle magazine over the last 20 years, I've had the opportunity to visit many facilities and have developed familiarity with the pros and cons of these technologies. I don't endorse any particular technology or approach, but I have had very extensive experience with rotary drum systems, as well as the more simpler ones. Through my work with BioCycle, we do surveys of in-vessel vendors, and this is available in their publication, www.biocycle.net, and there's just a list from a couple years ago. These companies do change names, and different vendors are on this list, I'm sure, that I haven't yet seen, the newest. Moving on here, going back to sort of what Bob Rink was talking about, we have a challenge across the North America anyways. We don't have sufficient capacity really in place for really turning on the organic composting world. There's very few large facilities. There are hundreds of farm scale, but they're typically limited by a restriction on total processing capacity per year or per day. I list here a couple of the larger facilities in the Northeast, Marlboro, Mass., where I worked, Nantucket, Delaware County, New York, which I'll show you some pictures of, Ipswich, Mass., Unity, Maine, to name a few. On-farm composters have the limited capacity. We have opposition typically to any large-scale commercial facility. The world of composting is littered with denied permits and NIMBYs that have successfully stopped projects. We've also lost capacity. The state of Massachusetts has lost 5 facilities in the last 5 years that were online doing food waste. A variety of reasons for that, but some of it was opposition from neighbors, some of it was economics. And then I like to point out that I don't see government, particularly state agencies, who are promoting composting and food residuals recycling, offering RFPs and long-term contracts for the waste from their own facilities. Not sure quite why, although some of them do, but there's a general trend to not provide that anchor to folks who want to invest in the millions of dollars to do this right. As Bob Rink pointed out, there are some problems associated with farm composting. Access can be limited. You may not be able to get to those fields in the winter. The low technology can bite them sometimes by odors, animals, vermin. Sometimes farmers don't have charge enough to sustain their own operations. But I've also seen farmers get greedy and just take in a lot of material because they like the $20 or $30 a ton, but then they get into other problems. It's pointed out many times that it's a secondary priority for farmers, especially if they're running a large dairy, to spend the time to do it right. Inorganic contaminants, I'm going to talk about a little bit later, but that's always an issue. And, of course, neighbor opposition. There are more. Large-scale composting has plenty of impediments. Frankly, it's got a poor performance history in North America. I could probably list 10 large-scale facilities that used to be in existence that are no longer operating. They typically have high capital and operating costs. Your landfill tip fees, particularly in further removed landfills in the Midwest and the South, where New York City rails its garbage, where a lot of large cities actually rely, those lower tip fees can actually be an impediment to developing closer-to-home composting. We also, coming back to what can government do, we don't have, other than landfill bans on yard waste, there are really no bans on food waste to landfilling. We do have San Francisco now with a mandatory or food waste recycling, but until we have a nationwide movement towards diverting at least pre-consumer and industrial food waste from disposal, I don't see this industry growing significantly fast. And then there's been, in the mixed waste composting world, and I lived this, poor quality compost. And odor is always an issue. It is manageable, though. We'll talk about that. I guess, as they said, there's some of the slides are slow to load. Inorganic contaminants. This is a farm in Massachusetts that takes in food waste from supermarkets and colleges and in outdoor windrows, and you can see the plastic contaminants. This is the farmer's tub grinder. It has a problem with too much plastic. Plastic bags are tend to clog equipment, greeners too. I'm going to talk about a few facilities, and Gary, the DEC, had asked me to focus on a few New York facilities. One of the longest running, fairly large scale food waste composting facilities is operated by the City of New York Department of Sanitation, and this is at Rikers Island, which is a correctional facility, and I'll show you some pictures of it. But that's it's been in business, in operation since 96, I believe. Here we go. Odor control was very important in the design of that facility. Even though they have a captive audience nearby, they still didn't want to create odor problems. Everything's processed within the buildings. The building air goes into biofiltration. The compost bays are aerated to control the temperature and moisture, and the curing piles are aerated. This is the blower aisle, similar to what Bob just showed at that other facility, aerating the bays on the right and moving the exhaust air out to the biofilter on the left. There is the biofilter. It's vegetated. It's just a simple biofilter in the ground adjacent to the building. By the way, this facility is being totally rebuilt and retrofit as we speak. The technology used there is a IPS, agitated aerated windrow. They process 10 tons per day on average of food waste from the prison, and they use the compost on site in the vegetable gardens and landscaping. But basically, you can see the concrete channels. There's aeration blowers, and there are zones that are controlled by computer and feedback on temperature. Just to sum it up, it's the largest municipal prison in the country, 17,000 inmates, probably process about 5,000 tons per year in IPS. It's operated privately by under contract to WeCare Organics. There is a trend in this country for municipal and public facilities to contract out their operations, and there's some good reasons for that. Anyway, there's some more information on that facility there, but we don't need to go over. As we saw, there's two bays in that building, and the piles are typically turned on a daily basis, and the agitator moves the material down the bay over the course of 21 days. It dries the material out and keeps it aerobic and helps reduce odors. There's a shot of the infeed end at Rikers Island Compost Facility. They load the food waste, and they load in a batch of chipped wood that they process from yard waste. And the agitator runs on rails and moves the material down the bay. This shows the screened final product. It is screened outside on the left and the unscreened material on the right. The New York State, not the city, but the New York State Department of Corrections has over 35,000 on-site composting facilities. Many of the New York State farms have prisons have a farm associated with it. And a gentleman by the name of Jim Marion spearheaded this effort probably 15 years ago. They use a variety of technologies from Wright environmental vessels, which I'll show you, to aerated bays, which we've just looked at, to just covered windrows. There's one of the barns with used on a New York State Corrections Facility site. The Wright environmental system, this is an example at a college, Allegheny College, my alma mater, but I'm proud to say they have implemented an in-vessel system at Allegheny, and there's many other applications around the world, frankly. Similarly, there's about a 21-day retention time, and the material is agitated and aerated inside a container. The compost that comes out requires curing afterwards. That's what the Wright environmental box system looks like. It has an internal air circulation and mechanical agitation system that moves the material down in a process flow. The largest composting facility in New York at this time is a mixed waste composting plant in Delaware County. Co-composting is the term for mixing a variety of materials. I'll show you some photos of it, but if you look to the left of the building, there's a brown area with some pipework. That's the biofilter, probably about a 30,000 square foot biofilter for treating all the building air. This uses a rotary drum technology out of France called Comparac, and they have one drum which processes close to 100 tons per day of mixed municipal solid waste as well as some agricultural waste. After 3 days in that drum, the material goes through a coarse screening step, and then it's discharged into the aerated bays using, again, the IPS system. At this point, they add some biosolids, and the process has a 50-day retention period. They have focused significantly and done well on the product quality here. It's a very impressive product considering the input materials of mixed solid waste. And I have to give the county credit, and Susan McIntyre, the solid waste director there, showing her compost sample. They rely on a private marketing company, another division of WeCare called WeCare Organics, and WeCare moves all the product out into a whole variety of uses in central New York and down in the Hudson River Valley, mulches, turf, blends, landscaping, top dressing, and also more recently erosion control. There's a whole other type of technology called put out by BW Organics. They have a series of different size rotary drums, and their food waste applications, the last time I checked with them about a year ago, included these installations, colleges and correctional facilities primarily. One of their flagship installations is at a Toyota manufacturing plant in I think it's Franklin, Kentucky. This has been written up in BioCycle, I think it was 2 years ago, but They serve in the cafeteria to their employees meals. They take both pre- and post-consumer. I'll show you the sorting centers, and then they blend it with yard waste in a BW Organics drum, and then they have a extensive on-site use for their compost. They start plants and ornamentals in greenhouses. They grow vegetables, and they use it in landscaping. That's the BW drum showing the two different in-feeds, one for the yard waste bulking agent, one for the food waste. It goes into a mixer and then into the drum. This is one of the earth stations for compostables. They have pin-up examples of what they can put in there. They use biodegradable serviceware and packaging, so all those paper products and polylactic acid-coated PLA cups, et cetera, along with the food waste and soil paper can go into composting. And next to it is conventional recyclables and trash. Another example of a BW drum, and this is at Montclair State University in New Jersey, a small drum behind their conference center. Again, this is primarily operated by the food service staff, so they do scrape plates from the conference center and separate in behind the scenes. They mix with cardboard and wood shavings, and they're processing about 1,000 pounds per day. And there was no permit required. It's just a registration in many states. That's Dr. Nick Sebastos-Smith, who some of you may have met, standing proudly with his drum. Another technique is the aerated roll-off containers. NatureTech has a series of these. I believe there's a couple in New York City, the Botanical Gardens. Another technology is engineered compost systems. They offer a variety of approaches to in-vessel covered piles, as Dr. Rink was explaining at the bottom there. Some states consider in-vessel. I'll show you a couple examples of these. They have installations all over the country. There's some examples for food waste. I'm going to talk briefly about West Yellowstone, Montana. They take food waste from the concessions in Yellowstone National Park, where the staff separate both pre- and post-consumer. The material is then taken to the West Yellowstone composting facility, shown here. They use two types of bags. The blue bags have the compostables, and the white, the non-compostables, and the claw there picks them out. You see the cardboard set aside. This will be put into a mixing drum and pulped to pre-process it into a mixer and then conveyed inside these aerated tunnels, which engineered compost systems designs and builds. The conveyor fills them, and the door is shut, and it's aerated and moisture-controlled for about 14 days. There's the doors closed. And then the material is discharged and put into aerated turned windrows. You can even see behind Randy Williams there the aeration trenches where material has just been moved. That's Kathy O'Hearn, the facility manager, who's now working for the state of Montana DEQ. And she's a real pioneer in this industry out west in particular. They have a biofilter covered with a roof for odor treatment. Biofilters underneath that control moisture. And they make a decent product there from their material. Even though you saw a fair amount of plastics and inerts, they're able to screen it out. They use a Bivitec and some destoning equipment. And they sell that product. And it's actually used within Yellowstone National Park on land reclamation and roadside construction. And thanks a lot. Keep your sense of humor. Ha-ha. So I think I made my time, and I'll look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Great last slide. Our last speaker today is Tom Lawson. Tom is the PE. He's the Vice President of Engineering and Development for Northeast Biogas, LLC. That's abbreviated NEB. He has 37 years' experience in engineering and is a licensed professional engineer in New York, Ohio, and Michigan. His degree in civil engineering is from the University of Windsor in Windsor, Ontario. That's Canada. Northeast Biogas is an alternative energy developer whose business model is to build, own, and operate anaerobic digestion facilities to profitably generate renewable energy and useful byproducts utilizing all manner of organic waste feedstocks. In his position with NEB, Mr. Lawson oversees the technical evaluation application of various anaerobic digestion processes to each potential project opportunity. He's also responsible for the design, permitting, and construction of each anaerobic digestion facility. Tom?
Thank you, Gary. And I thank Bob and Bob for leading the way on this afternoon's webinar. You're going to see some common threads from their discussion embedded in mine, and you're going to see some differences. So let's go in a little bit different direction, and let's talk for about the next 20 minutes on anaerobic digestion and digesters. And I'm going to do it in a sequence. I'm first going to try to get you to look at organic waste in a little bit different vein of the way the U.S. has historically handled it, much the way Bob and Bob have kind of acclimated you to. And then I'm going to get into anaerobic digestion itself and digesters and the differences between them. I'm going to show you some pictures, and then I'm going to do some wrap-up slides. Okay, so let's take a little bit different view. When is waste really not a waste, or maybe is it perhaps a resource? Well, in the U.S., particularly in the municipal market, it has historically been a pain in the neck, and it's been a cost. It's expensive to get rid of, and people just assume not to deal with it. So let's start with a few different definitions. You have waste, and you have biomass, but perhaps it's a resource. So with some simple definitions, refuse waste, historically at least, has been termed as garbage or trash and nothing that's very pleasant. Biomass and organic waste, I'm going to have literary license and define it as just organic material that comes from both plants and animals. But a resource is something that is an available supply that can be drawn upon when needed, and I would submit to the audience that perhaps waste and biomass is, in fact, the resource. We're going to give you some examples. Okay, manure. Manure is an organic waste. Comes from our friends to the right of the slide. It may not have the same energy potential as, say, the food materials that Bob and Bob have talked about, particularly because a lot of the energy has been extracted by the animal's digestive system. Food scraps. Bob and Bob have talked about that, so I won't dwell on that, but there's a lot of it, and it comes from both speaking from the material, it comes from material that doesn't quite make it to the shelf, it comes from food process side streams, when materials through a manufacturing facility, either maybe the labeling's wrong, or the material's slightly off spec, got to go somewhere, historically it's gone to the landfill. Yard and landscape byproducts, lawn clippings, bush trimmings, wood chips, all those types of stuff that fall into that category. Sawmill side streams, slash that come from right-of-ways, or even storm debris. Algae, that's another very viable and very useful organic waste material once it serves its purpose. And grasses. You'll find that grasses and materials in Europe particularly are grown as energy products for anaerobic digestion systems. Okay, now I'm going to get into a little bit of background on digesters and digestion once I've kind of giving you this intro on organic material. Anaerobic digestion, I'm going to simply define it as a natural process that converts biomass to energy under oxygen-free conditions. Now, you'll see a difference between compost, and that compost is done in an oxygen environment. This is an oxygen-free situation. And bacteria are the most important factor, much the same as with composting. You want to keep the bugs happy or you're not going to get what you want out of the process. There is a difference with digestion, and it's a net energy gain. It produces energy, and I'll show you more as we go through the slides. And you get some very useful byproducts out of it if you optimize your post-digested material. Okay, there are three, according to the literature anyway, anaerobic digestion operational temperature range. The cyclophilic
in the 68 degree Fahrenheit range is not a very common process, and it's not used very much, and the reason is it's not very effective. It doesn't produce very much gas, and that's what we're after, is the biogas, and particularly the methane component, which we'll explore as we go through the slides. The most common, at least in the wet systems, which again I will describe in a minute, is the most prevalent system, and it operates about 95 to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. And it'll typically produce what they call Class B solids. Now, that's defined in U.S. EPA under Title 40, Part 503. And it's also considered to be what, in engineers like acronyms, is a PSRP, which means that it's a process to significantly reduce pathogens. On the other side, you've got thermophilic digestion processes, which will run in 125 to 140 degree range, and they'll produce a Class A solid. Now, for those that particularly want to have a lot of flexibility with the byproduct coming out of anaerobic digestion, you're looking for a Class A solid because theoretically then your pathogens are no longer detectable. So again, our acronym is PFRP, which is Process for Further Reduction of Pathogens. I will point out that that U.S. EPA reference was originally penned for municipal sludges, but it has application and definition with regard to the materials out of digestion also. Okay, wet anaerobic digestion is most commonly found, the different processes that are out there in the various vendors, in the mesophilic range. Mesophilic is a more forgiving process. You have a much higher biomass ratio. Bear in mind, though, that whether it's wet or dry, the main component that's going to go into your digester is a feedstock, is water. Incoming solids are usually less than 15%. That's because you're mixing the material, you're moving the material, and quite frankly, you can't pump material once it gets around 15% solids or more. It just is not manageable. You're going to see the residence time here is usually 60 to 95 days. For those that go back as far as I do and municipal digesters, you're going to see that that's in the order of 2 to 3 times the residence time in typical wastewater treatment digesters. Dry anaerobic digestion, the main component is, again, water. Incoming solids here, you'll notice, are 20 to 45%, and the residence time is significantly less. It's in the range of 9 to 45. Now, think of residence time as a direct result of the material you're putting in, the temperature you're operating the process at, and the process system itself, how it's mixed, how the parameters are being controlled. It all is going to affect your residence time, so you can see the differences on that slide between the two type processes. Okay, I'm just going to give you a thumbnail sketch of what most of you have typically encountered in the way of digestion, if you've encountered it at all. And it's typically either a flood flow system that you're going to see a lot of, particularly in New York. You're going to see lagoons, and you're going to see some complete mix system. Okay, flood flow digesters, and you'll see later in slides, there's about 15 operating in New York State, are considered low rate. Basically, a plug flow system is what you put in, you're going to get out the other end in the same sequence that you put it in. They're not a real efficient system. Most of the reasons are they're not mixed. Usually the tankage is in the ground, as is with the lagoons, so therefore you've got the temperature of the ground that's affecting the bugs, and they're not real happy when the ground gets cold. Complete mix is low rate based on the way you're feeding it, but it is a complete mix system and you are heating it. So it's a continual mix, it's a continual heating arrangement, and you'll see as we continue, it's much more efficient and productive with regard to the byproducts. Okay, everybody likes to find a little bit about cost and orders of magnitude, so these next couple of slides will start to give you a little feel for that. Obviously, every project is different, but this will give you some rough parameters. If you're talking a wet-type anaerobic digestion system, a one tank in particular, you're going to look at about a 2 to 3 acre site. You're going to need at least one building because you're going to have elements that need to be out of the weather, and that would be your control room. Usually there's a CHP or a combined heat and power unit. You're going to have a mixing area, and you're going to have some regular human facilities in there. So you're going to have one building. Your project costs are going to be in up in the neighborhood of $4 million. It's heavily site-dependent, and as noted here, it's heavily dependent on the available organic waste material that you're going to handle, which is basically your fuel supply and how readily available is to the site that you've selected. The two-digester tank system, about 5 to 6 acres. Notice it's not necessarily linear. Again, you're going to need one building. Project costs up to about $5 million. Again, heavily dependent on the available organic waste. I will tell you, all the experiences that I've had and literature that I've seen, you don't get that much more gas from a two-tank system than you do a one-tank system. So you really have to decide if it's really worth the investment, and usually the numbers don't work. Okay, dry-type systems, they fall into two major categories, batch and continuous. The batch type are going to have the higher solid drain. You're going to need pre-screening for all the reasons that my associates prior to me have mentioned. You've got a lot of contamination that's typically part of municipal waste. And obviously the glass, the plastics, the china and utensils, they don't digest any more than they compost. Rough estimate is a 5 to 10 acre site to handle about a 35,000 to 40,000 tons, and that's U.S. short tons per year. And I have there one or two stages. You'll find, and I'm going to show you an example later, these often are two stages in that the first stage is the actual digestion phase, if you will, that can run around 6 weeks. And then many times the material will stay in the same compartment and will undergo composting, which can run another 6 weeks, after which the material is then removed and it ages. Continuous type, lower end of the solid drain, again, you're going to need pre-screening. Single stage, usually for the high solid, multi-stage for your low solid material. And vessels can be horizontal or vertical, and they're more site efficient. Now, I'm going to tell you in general that the digestion culture and the acceptance of the technology in Europe is probably 20 to 30 years ahead of the United States. Much more common, much more comfortable. There's hundreds of the wet systems in existence operating in Europe, and you're not going to find many at all in the United States. Maybe probably less than 100 overall across the whole United States, maybe less than 50. And then you're going to find that the continuous systems, the horizontal and vertical, again, European. CompoGas is one that will run a horizontal configuration. They're out of Germany. You're going to see Valagra is another outfit. They're out of France. They run a vertical vessel. They can be more site efficient, throughput's a little bit faster, but you're going to see varieties, and you have to do your homework to glean the differences between the two. Particularly with regard to municipal solid waste, dry digestion is not common in the U.S. at all. There's a fledgling operation outside San Francisco run by the East Bay Municipal Authority, which is commonly referred to as East Bay Mud. There's been a couple that have been tried up in Ontario. One is still operating, to my knowledge. One is not presently operating, and they're trying to develop another one. So you're not going to find much history in the U.S. at all. It's even further behind as a dry process than the wet process is. So I've extracted this information for your benefit, and if you want, that website at the bottom will give you the full report. It was done in California. It was done in 2008, and it was based on 2007 numbers from Europe. So I will caution you, it's noted here, $2,007 dollars. So watch for your inflation, and also these are in metric tons. You will again notice that both with the capital and with the operating costs, they're not linear when you go from, say, 50,000 metric tons a year to 100,000 metric tons a year. So just to give you a ballpark feel, it's by no way gospel. Again, it's project and site specific, but it will give you at least some feel for orders of magnitude. Okay, what are the byproducts that we're after out of anaerobic digestion? Well, obviously, the raw substrates, just like my associates have mentioned to you, is going to significantly affect what you get out of the digestion process. But what you're really after, what I am selfishly after of every one of my projects, is I want to get the methane out. Now, methane can run between, say, 60 and 70%. I've seen operations be as high as 70%. More commonly, they run around 60 as a comparison. Landfill gas, as an example, will probably run around 55%. And your carbon dioxide numbers adjust accordingly, so if you have 70% of methane content, you're roughly going to have 30% of carbon dioxide, and then you're always going to have trace elements of your hydrogen sulfide, your water vapor, and whatnot. I will tell you that digester gas from anaerobic digesters is closer to natural gas than, say, landfill gas. You don't have the same contaminants that you have in landfill gas, and you don't have one very bad actor, which is called polyethylene, which tends to be a silica-type precipitate that will end up fouling up your combined heat and power engine. Your post-digested material, you can usually get a 50% reduction through your digester, and again, I'm going to caution you, that's on the volatile content of your input, not on your inert, so obviously sand and gravel, anything else that may sneak through, that's not going to digest. And then you can compost the material that comes out of your digester, much the same as my associates have indicated to you. Or most commonly, too, you'll dewater it. And you can use the liquid from your press, which is usually a screw press, as fertilizer. Your solids coming out of the screw press are going to run around 30%. And solids can be used for bedding, which is very common in the stalls of the dairy barns in Europe and is gaining some traction in the U.S. as a soil amendment, or even you can dry the material as pellet fuel. Okay, why do we do all this? Well, we'd like to make a few pennies out of this when we get all said and done. So what are the things we're after? Well, we're after revenue, and one of them is electricity. Electricity produced from your CHPs, which are combined heat and power, that's what that acronym stands for, or also you'll find the word genset used a lot. It's a combination engine generator set. Now, electricity is the normal way you go up to about 1.5 megawatts. Once you get to that range, you will note that the economics can tip in your favor, and particularly if you're near a gas line and you can meet the specifications and requirements for the gas distributor, you may be able to inject right into the gas line. You're also after the heat from the CHP. Now, there's three sources of heat that come off these gensets. One is the engine oil, and the second is the water that cools the jacket of the engine. Those run around about 200 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're going to get the exhaust gases, which are in the neighborhood of 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have three sources which you can harness, and that gives you additional available heat that you can use for your process, either as a side stream to heat the digester, or if you're near an industry, or you're near some other entity that can use the heat year-round. And we've got a couple of projects we're developing that can use it year-round, and that's a real benefit for you. You also can get the carbon dioxide off of it, and you get the post-digested material, and the bedding, which I mentioned, the carbon credits, and your tipping fee. Now with some pictures. This is a picture from Germany. This is from the vendor Entepec. You'll notice the digesters are all covered. There's a double membrane cover. The diameters run between 80 and 100 feet, and the heights are around 26 feet. This is a typical engine generator. You notice the engine component on the left, the generator on the right. These systems are heavily automated. They're not like the systems that I saw 25, 30 years ago. These are all monitored, instrumented, and connected to SCADA. And generally, they're also connected to the vendor sold the system, who monitors it on a constant basis. This is a slide that's from the Aiken process. This is the batch system out of Denmark. If you follow from the bottom right across to the left, you'll note the material comes in. It's sorted. The raw material, food waste, and structure, which is generally wood chips and inert material, is mixed together. It's loaded into the cells. There was a picture in one of Bob's presentations earlier kind of showed you this. The material is is digested in the cell for about 6 weeks, and then once the digestion is finished, the air is introduced, and it's composted for another 6 weeks. So, as I say, this is a Danish process. And this is a picture of one of the facilities. This one happens to be in Norway. You'll see that they do get snow in Norway, even though, like in New York, we don't get snow in March anymore. Okay, these are wrap-up slides. There's about 15 operating anaerobic digesters in New York, as I mentioned. Most all are plug flow types. They're almost all on farms, and the main focus was for manure handling, reduction, and control, if you will. Most operating less than 60% efficiency. That's based off of data that I've seen on the NYSERDA data bank. And as Bob mentioned earlier, they're not designed to handle food. They were designed to handle manure. Generally, organic food waste will run 14 to 18% of municipal waste streams. The solids, again, are 20 to 45%. Remember that in the eyes of the bugs, they prefer sugars first, carbohydrates and proteins. So it's a definite pecking order. And the common thread with all that is bugs like carbon. That's what they want to go after and eat first. Water has no fuel value, and water has to be heated. The quality of the input, organic waste feedstock, is very important because it's a little bit like computers. What goes in is what comes out. Your feedstock sources need to be within a reasonable radius. Your feedstock sources need to be consistent because you want to maintain a constant recipe of input materials in the digesters. Your economics and type of materials that are available are going to drive your digester size. You want to design for energy output. In Europe, they design principally for tipping fees. That's not so in the U.S. And again, you want to look for your output product as a Class A type product for maximum ability to distribute. If you're looking to do development, site location is important. The accessibility of the site, the environmental impact. You can look at both brownfields and greenfields. I will say if you can find an acceptable brownfield site, you probably have existing infrastructure there and access to it that can save you some development costs. Your site infrastructure, don't also forget your utilities. You're going to need electric out if you're going to wheel it to the grid, which digestion systems generally use in the neighborhood of 4% of electricity to maintain a process. You get that about 90% that you can wheel to the grid, or you got to be able to connect to it, and also you're going to have utilities into your site, such as potable water. You've got permitting, usually on three levels to consider, federal, state, and local, and you can figure at least a good 6 months to get through the various hurdles that you need to get all your paperwork in order. You can figure about 6 months for construction, particularly if you get started late in the year and you have to go through winter construction. That tends to not only cost more, but to stretch things out. And you're also going to have to think about your agreements. You have development agreements, you have ownership agreements, purchase power agreements, supply source, and end product. So there's the whole fabric of the entire project that encompasses a wide spectrum of things you have to consider. Now, in summation, all is not lost. You don't have to just give up and get on the ground and pray. There's actually a way through this. It's manageable. Sometimes some questions will clear things up. There's also, you can get a hold of me if you wish, or you can go to the Northeast BioGuide website, and it'll give you a little bit of overview there also. So with that, I think I'm done, and I guess I'll turn it over to the moderator who can orchestrate the questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. This is Amy Wolfram again. We'd like to start the question and answer period now. As a reminder, questions can be submitted via the question and answer Q&A tab at the top of your screen, top left. And as a reminder, please put the person's name if you have the presenter's name in front, and I'll ask all the questions out loud so everybody will be able to hear them and help direct them. So as a start, the first question is for Bob Brink. Bob, does composting lead to cost savings across the chain of custody of food waste? For example, from the generator to the composter versus conventional waste in disposal in landfills?
I would say that it can. Does it in every situation? Probably not. And the determining factor is distance. The transportation cost to wherever its ultimate destination is going to determine which is the cheapest option. So if the landfill's far away, taking food waste to a local composter, yeah, it could lead to savings. But it's obviously cheaper to take a load of food waste and put it into the ground and cover it up with soil, as it do with a landfill, than it is to manage it through a composting process. So comparing the two process to process, I would say no, it's going to cost more to compost it. But the real question is, where is it? Where is the food, and where is the facility it's ending up being? Now, in composting, you're going to recover some of that cost by selling the compost that you make out of the food. But, again, only a small proportion of that food is going to end up in the compost. Most of it's going to decompose and become carbon dioxide.
Okay, thank you. This question is for Bob Spencer. How does Rikers Island compost get used, or who's the end user of the Rikers Island compost, and how, and do they sell it?
It is not sold. It is used by the corrections staff in landscaping on Rikers Island, and they also grow vegetables for use in the kitchens. So it's used on site.
Great. Thank you. This would be a question regarding digesters, and is it likely that brown fields can be used for digesters?
The answer to that question is yes. And to expand on it, if you can find a site as an example that may be at an old landfill site or adjacent to one or even possibly in companion with an existing one, then it's possible to share infrastructure, i.e. you could share the utilities that are already there. You could possibly share the scale house because you need to measure loads, weigh your loads as they come into the site so you can know what you're accepting. So I'd say yes, very definitely, under the right conditions.
Great, thank you. This question is for all of the presenters. Are there any facilities that use plasma high-temperature process to generate syngas energy from organic and municipal solid waste?
This is Tom Lawson. I will say that there are a couple that I'm aware of that are being looked at and developed, but I'm not aware of one operating in the U.S. In fact, I would submit that there is not off-the-shelf technology available in the U.S. to, say, through gasification, produce syngas.
This is Bob Rink. I agree with Tom. I don't know of any gasification facilities that are operating, but there is a lot of interest. And if you take the high plasma energy out of the question, I would say there'll be some gasification facilities up and running in the relatively near future. We here at SUNY Cobleskill, we in fact have a pilot gasifier in our way and going to be installed for research purposes. I hope for that. So I think it's a promising technology, but it's going to require relatively low moisture feedstock, of which food is not.
I would also, this is Tom Lawson, I would just quickly echo what Bob said earlier, and that is there's a perception that when you come up with new technology like gasification, the populace tends to think of it in terms of something else that they know, so they tend to equate it with incineration, and that has concerns from the old dioxin fears of days gone by.
Okay, thank you for that. On to the next question. Tom, this one's for you. Will you please speak about the odor issues with anaerobic digestion as compared to composting systems?
Anaerobic digestion, by the way these systems are presently designed, are not totally odor-free. I won't ever submit that they are because you can have a hiccup, if you will. But the material comes in trucks, immediately put into tanks which are covered and sealed. And as the picture was shown on the slide presentation, the digesters themselves are covered and sealed. And are the byproduct tanks or the substrate tanks that take the material out of the digester. So the first time the material really gets exposed to the air would be in the dewatering process. And quite frankly, by that time, it's quote-unquote stabilized because it's going through the digestion process. What you'll get is more of a musty odor. And the liquid actually looks like a light brown liquid, almost like a brewer's beer or whatnot. So I'm going to say no, but can you get a hiccup every once in a while? Yes. Is it significant? No.
Okay. Tom, to follow up on that question, when do you guess that we'll see more widespread anaerobic digestion infrastructure, and what would you like to see happen to jumpstart more widespread use?
Well, I would say two things. Well, maybe three. One is that the culture of the U.S. has been more of a disposable mentality for as long as I've been off the face of this earth. Secondly of all, the economic situation in the last few years has really cut back on investor dollars in technologies like this. Banks, when you want to look at it, you're finding that the money that's out there is individual money, more angel money, if you will, private investors. And lastly of all, as one of the, my other predecessors, associates, mentioned, the landscape of regulation in the U.S. is not conducive yet to heavy development like it is in Europe. Vermont just had a fee and tariff regulation that went in last year that's probably closest to Germany. And as an example, in Germany, under the right conditions, you can get as much as 23 cents a kilowatt. You can't get close to that in the U.S. So there needs to be a more level playing field and more incentives to develop this technology.
Okay. Thank you. As a further follow-up, what are the typical, for Tom, what are the typical environmental impact concerns in the Northeast? And this also relates, are there odors, truck traffic, NOx, VOC emissions? Speak to that.
No, there's most of these systems, you're trying the vast majority of systems in Europe and even here when you start looking at what it takes to run a digester as far as feedstock. These systems will run around 500 kilowatts to 1 megawatt. There's not heavy truck traffic. You're talking probably in the order of, oh, maybe 3-4 trucks a day, okay? And these, bear in mind, these digesters run 24/7. So they're a lot more efficient than solar systems or wind in that you're operating all the time. And even your gen sets, the way they're designed nowadays, CHPs, your uptime is 90%. As far as permitting, in New York State, you're looking at a Part 350 permit, which is a solid waste permit. You have to go through air permitting. These engines are much better than the ones I was designing and installing 25 years ago. So you're very little SOx and NOx. 500 kilowatts, you may only need air registration. You may not even need a permit, depending on where you're located. You'll need stormwater permit. Locally, you're going to need at least a building permit to build. Depending on where you're siting, you may or may not be in the right zoning. You may need a variance, or if you're trying to put it where it doesn't belong, like in a residential subdivision, then you're probably not going to be able to build it at all because you will be out of compliance. And then depending, again, on the site, you may have wetlands, stormwater, other concerns like that, and then the normal things such as connecting to the utility or Department of Health for water permit, things like that. So very manageable, nothing unusual compared to other projects that most people would develop, but you do have to cover all the bases.
Okay. This is also a follow-up for you, Tom. The attendee wanted to speak about one of your slides. One of your slides mentioned mesophilic class B and thermophilic class A biosolids.
Correct.
Their previous review of 503 regulations indicated that anaerobic digestion alone, whether meso or thermo, was not sufficient for class A unless followed by additional processing such as composting. Has this changed or was their understanding off?
I don't believe things have changed based on my most recent review. I would say if you sustain thermophilic temperatures for the prescribed period of time, then you satisfy class A solid. Conversely, if you go to the mesophilic and you want class A solid, and then you were to compost the material and maintain the prescribed temperatures for the prescribed duration, then you would also satisfy class A solid stipulation.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to look a little bit at composting now. One of the questions was, are there any good technologies for small on-site composting for food waste at schools or small food service locations? So and this wasn't directed at a certain or a certain presenter.
Well, this is Bob Spencer. There are quite a few small appropriate on-site technologies out there. Those rotary drums are being distributed at a very small scale by a number of vendors, BW Organics. There's something called the Rocket, which is installed at a number of institutions. There's a green drum. There's a couple rotary drum manufacturers. There's also something put out by Green Mountain Technologies, the Earth Tub, which has sold hundreds of units around the world. They also, Green Mountain Technologies, has a new, little larger scale earth bin. It's got an auger system and agitated systems. Transform Compost Systems out of British Columbia has a number of on-site smaller scale technologies they make available with agitated turning machines. Nature Tech, I mentioned that one. There's also O2 Compost, which has a very simple aerated static pile design, and they are doing food waste. They have a project in Syracuse, New York right now, and some other small installations. So yes, there are quite a variety of small appropriate on-site composting technologies out there, and quite a range of costs too. That's just a few that I've mentioned.
Okay, thank you. This next question is for Tom, and we can combine a couple questions here. Many of the biogas facilities in other parts of the world, particularly Europe, have large government subsidies. Have there been any incentives by our government to promote this innovative energy source? And do you see them catching on in the U.S. as in Europe?
Yes, I think they're catching on. Yes, you've noticed if you watch the various state legislatures putting forth different bills, if you will, to stimulate the activity. Vermont was one I mentioned before. Massachusetts also has recent legislation in 2009. So, yes, it's coming. I do see inconsistencies, obviously, from state to state. Part of the incentives also are being driven by the cost of energy in the various states. As an example, Connecticut, Massachusetts, power in general is more expensive than it is, say, in the western part of New York State. So, yes, I think the incentives are coming. They're coming not so much yet from a federal level. They're coming more from the state level. And I think it's, again, a cultural thing. I think we've got to come to grips as a country with the fact that this material actually has value, that digestion in and of itself, any more than composting, is not a silver bullet, if you will, it's going to solve all your problems. But it is an integrated technology that with wind and solar and other ones can help get us off of our total reliance or almost total reliance on the fossil fuel. So, yes, I think it's going to be there. The other thing you got to bear in mind a little bit, and it's a thing that we wrestle with anaerobic digesters, is power generation in Europe is different than the U.S. They are more a distributed power, where we tend to have our grid set up for major energy plants and not so much smaller contributors. So that's another thing. The utilities have got to adjust their distribution.
Great. Thank you. The next question is also for Tom. Can you summarize how food waste feedstock specifications change for various types of anaerobic digestion systems?
It's a big question. Well, first of all, if you look at the different food sources, they each have biogas potential. Okay, so as an example, as I mentioned, the materials that have sugar contents and carbohydrates have a higher feedstock potential than other materials. And there's more literature in Europe than there is in the U.S., but Cornell is doing a good job and has done a good job at categorizing and listing different types of materials and what the biogas potential is. And as I mentioned in my slideshow, the more water you get from some of your materials, you're not going to get as much gas production. So as an example, if you have cabbage, it has a lot of gas production. But conversely, if you take grape pumice and apple pumice, you got a higher sugar content, you're going to get the potential for more gas production from your digester. So what you do is you look at the site where you think you want to site your digester, and then you have to take inventory of what's reasonable distance-wise from a radius standpoint to feed your digester. Because just like one of my associates, Bob, mentioned, you know, trucking costs obviously play a role in this. It's all part of your economic model, which we built our own economic models with Northeast Biogas where we can evaluate now, okay, how much material do we need, what's available, what's the seasonality of it, and then come up with whether or not we've got an appropriate mix of materials that makes a digester viable. And if it's not, we're going to say, hey, you don't have enough material to make this a realistic project. Don't waste your money. So that's what you do, is you look at it. And in fact, one of the projects that we had last year as a company is we were fortunate to get a NYSERDA grant, and we did an inventory of pretty much the whole state of New York as to where the materials were. And that's another thing I'm sure all three of us would tell you, that historically that there wasn't any database that could tell you where the wastes were in New York, because, again, it was a waste. It wasn't a resource, so nobody took any time to try and cull the information to determine where the material was, how much of it there was, what quality it was, how seasonal is it. And now we have a lot of that. So we're making progress, and you have to really look at your organic waste as a fuel and determine, do you have enough fuel to make the digester worthwhile?
Okay, thank you. I realize that we didn't get all of the questions answered, but we're coming close to the end of the time period, so we'll answer the rest of them via the question log later. But Gary, I'd like to turn it over to you for closing. And you might want to take your phone off mute.
Thanks, Amy. I'll learn someday. And thank you, speakers. Thank you to everyone for participating in today's webinar. I'd also like to thank Amy Wolfram and Sherry Lawson of ICF International for their logistical support in setting up the webinars, Miranda, our operator, and Shane Nelson of US EPA for helping to organize the series. You can see Shane's email address on the PowerPoint slide there, and please email any questions not submitted via the Q&A feature to him at nelson.shane@epa.gov. A list of the questions and responses will be sent to all participants by email, as Amy said. Our last session in this five-part series is scheduled for April 7th. It will be on how to put together all the pieces to have a successful organics diversion program. We look forward to your participation then. Thank you.